This is Susan Evans, February 14th, 1990. Active, I'm Musing. Active Imagination and the Arts of the Muses. Tape 1 of 1.
Because I haven't even begun yet. I'm Susan Evans. Celia was going to introduce me, but since she isn't able to be here this evening, she asked if I would mind introducing myself. So, you know a few things about me from the brochure. You know that I'm a performing artist. You know that I'm a singer. What it doesn't mention in there, and I think it's quite interesting for Psychological Society that the one area that was totally left out is my credits as a dancer and choreographer. A lot of what we're going to be talking about tonight does involve the body. It happens to do with some of the spheres of the muses up here in the arts and a way that you can coordinate active imagination and participation in the arts, whether as a performer, professionally or non-professionally, or as an audience. There's an energy exchange there that is extremely important for the magic of what can happen in the arts to work. So I was also executive director of Oregon Volunteer Lawyers for the Arts for a number of years, so I have a heavy administrative and legal background in the arts as well. In order to keep me from going on at length beyond my assigned time, my son has loaned me his watch. So we have about 45 minutes before a break, and I'm going to be talking about this wonderful work. Before I actually start the lecture, I'd like to tell you why I'm interested in this particular piece, how it came about, and to share with you a bit of music from 5th century BC Greece. In ancient traditions, any artistic endeavor was begun with an invocation to the muses or the muse. So I thought it would be most appropriate to have something from this album. This is a wonderful album where we have the remnants of what actually exists from ancient Greece. This is Musique de la Grèce Antique. It's the Atrium Musici de Madrid. It's Gregorio Paniagua. And they spent lots of time reconstructing the instruments. And wherever there are fragments that were made it impossible for them to translate the work, they left those sections with drum beats. The sections I'll play for you tonight are all intact, so you will be hearing music that was played 5th century BC on instruments that were created exactly in the same way, so we can recreate at least that much of a touchstone. This particular work itself is not from classical Greece. This is from 1496. It's a Neoplatonic work. To begin with, I'd like to play a section that you will hear later, a Cretan hymn to the sun. So you can see from the top here, Apollo is a major figure in the work. And right after the hymn to the sun, there's an invocation to the muse. And then the lecture itself will begin. The hymn to the sun reads, "Let the heavens be silent, the earth, the sea, the winds, mountains, valleys, echoes, and the songs of birds keep silent. Phoebus of the long and beauteous hair is coming, father of the dawn, with eyes of dazzling white. You, with the glorious golden tresses, lead your rosy chariot along the limitless roads of the sky, following the winged footprints of the steeds, intertwining your curling rays, surrounding the whole earth with your resplendent light. Your rivers of immortal fire give life to the smiling day. For you, the imperturbable chorus of stars dances on Olympus, accompanying their free melody on Phoebus's lyre, and in front, the pale moon leads the rhythmic times of the seasons by the cadenced movement of white calves. Your benevolent spirit rejoices in turning the myriad-robed earth." It's followed by a hymn to the muse, specifically Calliope, and you'll hear her name in the text. Calliope of the Muses is the muse of heroic poetry, psychology, and theology, and of the muses, she's thought to be the one who leads the rest. The text there reads, "Sing, muse dear to me, and prelude my own song. Let a breeze come forth from your groves, make my soul tremble. O wise Calliope, who directs the gracious muses, and you whose wisdom initiates the mysteries, son of Latona, Deleon, Phaeon, help me with your favor." So these two sections are from 5th century BC. Connected back 2,500 years to a tradition that goes back a great deal farther than that. The importance of the arts and humanities in the world, in cultures throughout history, I don't have to say much about that. I did look at this cartoon that was recently in the Seattle paper that says, "No jobs, no opportunity, no education, poverty, bigotry, racism, crime, boredom, broken homes, abandoned social programs." Guy comes up, says, "Want to earn $1,000 a week selling drugs?" Just say, "What?" This is another alternative. And because a lot of my time in the past has been in teaching. I taught both comparative literature and Greek theater in schools. I feel very strongly about the fact that the absence of arts in our educational system is one of the major problems that we have in schools. And I'm not going to go on and on about that. I thought I would say it at the beginning. You know that's how it feels. So we'll go on and we'll talk about this wonderful work. There had been a time in my life where I had dropped out of the arts, and if you can imagine it, I was a technical writer for a computer software company. And I was attending a lot of the lectures with the Oregon Young Society before I was on the board, and Joseph Campbell came. I'd been ushering, so there were no seats left, and I was seated on the ground looking up. And all of a sudden, he broadcast this thing. It was this huge screen with a copy of this. And he talked about it just in passing, along with a great number of other things. But it was one of those moments that, for me, went, oh! It was a numinous hit. And I've been working with this particular symbol system for the last 5 years. And I imagine that, God's willing, I will be working with it for the rest of my life. There is a great deal more here than I can explain at this point, and there's certainly a great deal more here than I can do in 2 hours. Normally, when I give this presentation, I do it in a workshop and performance format where there's a section after the lectures where there are performance demonstrations, and also I'll create a myth workshop for people. So we have to kind of, you've got to do some of that imaginal work yourself tonight. Okay. Basically, we want to start, I think, with who are these cast of characters? We have a motto at the top. The motto here is, the energy of the Apollonian mind sets these muses everywhere in motion. It's a wonderful picture of bipolar energy because you can see the Dionysian element is not left out. You can't really consider one without the other. And this basically is a picture of how one might be able to use the arts in order to have creative containers for individuation that provide a safe container for energy forms. Artists basically, whether it's a participating, a professional, or an audience artist, have access to something that gives enough of a form for dynamic content to at least make it relatively safe. I mean, as Zorba said, unless man dares to go a little crazy, you're not going to be free. So I'm not saying that the arts are an utterly safe adventure. The motto indicates that this exploration of the mysterious pathways to the transpersonal realm shown in Practica Musici, it's called the Music of the Spheres. The schematic traces an evolution, a choice of creative motion that attaches to the numinous world, binding body, mind, and emotions together by a conscious realization of the true nature of the self employing them, genius. That aspect of ourselves that would identify with Apollo. It is a picture of a process, a creative sigh of inspiration and expiration, in which the muses are indeed moving everywhere as vital aspects of life and healing forces of creative power. Although the symbolism is largely a Neoplatonic expression of Greco-Egyptian forms, the archetypal energies invoked by Gaufurius through this symbolic constellation transcend time, space, and cultural representation. Whatever the culture or historical era, it is the muses who inspire our inspiring. In 1496, when the new world was being created or discovered, Gaufurius created this work, and it is vitally important for the new world we have created to remember its message. The dedication is to Apollo, and where Apollo rules, there are artistic challenges, intellectual and emotional stimulation, or that rarest art of accomplishment, the illuminating of the human spirit, the freedom of being in inner harmony with our own nature. This liberty comprises the full development of all the material, intellectual, and spiritual powers latent in all of humanity. It is a liberty restricted only by the psyche's laws for the pattern of essential nature emanating from the limitless great reality. While Edward Ettinger notes that something new emerging in the psyche can only gain admission into the psyche by following a previously established pattern, Joseph Campbell says that in a realm of freedom there are no archaic paths, and Stephen Heller suggests that we use the basic pathway by which we came, that we reawaken the centers existing already. The question then is, if indeed I have emanated from the great reality, it implies that I can get back. But I have to learn how. This paradoxical birth of self, myself, yourself, all selves, is the process of the music of the spheres. If it is said that an archetype may be seen as an image plus an emotion, it is an original model after which other similar things are patterned. The Greek archetypos means first molded as pattern or exemplary. The image is the concept of someone or something that is held by or projected to the public, and relating to an image requires imagination. To image is to make a likeness, mirror, reflect, project, or conjure up. From the Indo root, mag, it relates to greatness, and magnet, also imagination. So the great magical power is the ability of an individual within a certain symbol system to bring about the greatness of self. You'll see down here that there's Scalia. I've got to hold this up so you can see her. So you've got these muses over here, and as we'll discover, there's one down here, and she doesn't look terribly happy encased in the earthly realm. Of the muses, Thalia is the muse of comedy and nature. She's not on the side pattern here, and she ends up as the central figure at the top in the middle of the three graces. So it's tracing a kind of pathway that is available to all of us. The necessary emotion for this imaginative relationship is an imperative arousal to mutual recognition. The Latin emovere means to move out, stir up, or agitate. In this sense, conscious relationship to archetypal energies implies a stirring up of the images and a movement outward of expanding consciousness. Emotion is essential for activating the creative agency. We can only open these centers if we give them a chance to emanate creative power. And this is where the concept of being an artist, which is something we all have as children, all children are artists. We sort of lose it along the way. But this ability to play. People don't work music. They play music. Although as a professional performer, it's a job, it's work. There are nights I don't want to do it. Still, the concept is that the energy that you can experience in the play of the arts is something that we all have. To emanate creative power, emanation is to come forth. An emanationist is someone who feels that God pours itself forth and comes into manifestation, which manifestation contains its essence. Again, if indeed I have emanated from the great reality, it implies I can get back, but I have to know how. Well, there's the other side. Hillman warns against analysis that proceeds in only an Apollonian manner, labeling rather than experiencing what is symbolized. The muses do provide a context for creative containers. If, however, the imaginal activity becomes an end in itself, as often happens, unfortunately, in the professions, it may have the aesthetically seductive effect of concealing rather than curing the original problem for which the patient sought help. In this sense, it merely sets up another lane of defense against facing the personal shadow. That's according to Joseph Henderson. The process of imaginative identification and assimilation that releases creative meaning from an experience is our individual responsibility and depends upon our ability to creatively respond. Events do not just happen to us. We meet them and we give to them our own meaning. Met in this way, life is a mysterious, magical experience, an experience that the muses help to create. In order to fully experience, we need to be awake, aware, conscious, and unconscious together. In Modern Man in Search of a Soul, Dr. Jung stresses that the survival of the world depends upon closing the widening gulf between the conscious and unconscious aspect of the human psyche. A part of that gulf is bridged by psychology, the sphere of Calliope. It is a way of understanding. Understanding is standing under, bearing the awareness of meaning, the responsibility that such awareness brings. All sorts of creatures. Dr. Jung had a wonderful analogy of the unconscious that brings them all into play. If it were permissible to personify the unconscious, we might call it a collective human being, combining the characteristics of both sexes, transcending youth and age, birth and death, and from having at his, her, or its command a human experience of 1 or 2 million years, almost immortal. So, this collective consciousness brings us to the paternity and maternity of these muses. Who are these muses, and why is this lecture called Active Amusing? The muses are the daughters of Zeus, king of the gods, and Mnemosyne, a titaness whose name means memory. Mnemosyne knows all that has ever happened since the beginning of time. She's collective memory, collective unconscious. Another name for the muses is musei, or nei, memories. So active amusing is a kind of remembering, remember, to put back together, which is what Isis did with Osiris. We cannot relate to Apollo and the muses while excluding Dionysus, because we need to always bear in mind that lightning flash where the energy goes up and the energy comes down, and that's what makes the spark. Dionysus is associated in this particular work with this serpent. The serpent has three heads, the dog, the wolf, and the lion, which are associated with past, present, and future. The lion is the fiery face of the present, through which Thalia is going to have to pass in order to leave her unhappy state, where she's bound to the world's views, and rise to her state as the central figure between the other two graces. As far as Dionysus, well, I hope some of you have had a chance to read Robert Johnson's Ecstasy. Apollonian and Dionysian aspects taken together can create some wonderful flashes. One description of Dionysus in relation to the muses reads, among the gods who dance and in whose honor dances are given, Dionysus holds a place of first rank. In his character as god of wine, with which in a happy moment legend endowed him, he becomes the incarnation of joyous folly. He does not walk, he dances. Flutes and dulcimers accompany his processions. There is much noisy music in his honor. His one care is to banish care, to fill days with joy. He loves the mountains, the forests, the rivers. His temple is nature. These places are peopled with gods, men, or beasts who love the joys of life. Dionysus is, depending on the source, the son of Zeus and immortal Semele, or Zeus in his serpent form raped his daughter Persephone, daughter of Zeus again in his serpent form, Zeus had raped Demeter, and bore his son Dionysus, which makes Zeus his father and his grandfather, symbolically in the incest emphasizing the theme. The bipolar nature of this Apollo-Dionysus is expressed in a new Christian context from St. Hippolytus. Hippolytus, relating to the classical Greek name, in Phaedra, was the hero who was torn apart by horses, which is what his name means, being torn apart. So this dates from the 3rd century B.C. St. Hippolytus was part of an obscure sect called the Pirates. And he says, moreover, no one can be saved and rise up again without the Son, who is the serpent. For it was he who brought the paternal models down from aloft, and it is he who carries up again those who have awakened from deep sleep and have reassumed the features of the Father. Dionysus, the son of God as serpent energy and daughter of the earth. The snake as healing symbol is part of our ancient inheritance. It is the symbol we use for healing. The caduceus of Mercury graces our ambulances, while the Asclepian staff, Asclepius as son of Apollo, his name means unceasingly gentle, adorns most medical schools. And it is the central pillar in Gaphorius's work. The purpose of the serpent is to awaken us. As for the association with sexuality, transcendent sexual activity gears a progeny of spirit of mind. You know his birth, and his nature will explore. His death is important, too. The Titans tore him into 7 pieces, roasted him on 7 spits, the number 7 indicating a ritual that is initiatory, and they consumed him. Well, this did not set so well with Zeus, and from the ashes of the Titans, Zeus created humanity. In that sense, we are all of immortal Dionysian substance, and also of Titanic substance, mortal, crucified on the crossbars of time and space. Both Dionysus and Apollo are that part, within and without, of the ever-living God who dies to himself and lives in us all. According to Plutarch, during the Dionysian rite, they searched for Dionysus and then gave up the search, saying that he had fled to the Muses and hidden. And there, here, he is a source of beautiful creative power. By actively amusing, which is not a spectator sport, we can, as unique masks of God, participate in the spirit of creation of light. The whole concept of what it is to be an audience is a very important thing to me. I just finished doing the Seattle Opera Dialogue at the Carmelites. I was the 3rd executed nun. And it was an opera that had a varied response. And the audiences were very different. Audiences always are from a performer's point of view. But this particular opera, there were very different audiences. And the one audience that interacted with the stage well produced a performance that was far above what any of us did before that and what any of us did after that. It meant changing little things in our blocking. I mean, I'm about to die and I drop my veil, and usually I have to count it out, and suddenly there's this nun hanging on to me. It was really quite, it was a very spontaneous production, which would not have happened without that return from the audience. And in order for an audience to have that kind of dynamic activity, that means that they're being artists. Artists are not just the people on stage or the people writing the books. Artists are the people in the audience. And it takes both poles. If we don't have the arts in the schools, leading to other reasons for there are, I can't say free transcendent experiences. I know what ticket prices are, but there are these alternatives. The concept of an audience realizing that an audience is composed of artists is an important thing. When you go and you participate, you have the same ability as anyone on stage to take the experience that is happening and turn it into a creative container. Now, I will freely admit that every time I do any kind of a performance, I milk it for everything it's got. You know, I'm getting paid, and I'm on stage, and I also use it as a vehicle for a lot of inner work. What can I do with this experience? Why this one? Why am I doing this one now? How can I make that work? But anyone in an audience can do exactly the same thing. Most people on stage are not doing that kind of inner work. with their characters. They're learning their lines. Some people do. But in a large cast, you're not going to find that the overall mass is overly concerned with the effect of the particular role that they're playing on their inner life and their individuation. So that's something that is unique to anyone who wants to awaken that part of himself that is an artist, that we're all artists, that this is not a diagram that's talking about a select group of people who happen to do it as a profession. Everybody here, remember, Thalia is nature. She's nature and she's comedy. Now, there's some sort of a joke there. Yeah.
How do you spell that?
T-H-A-L-I-A. So of the muses, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. She definitely makes her transition from there to there. The muses, what do the muses do? Well, first of all, who are they? I should run that by you. We've got Cleo is history, mythology, and philosophy. Calliope is heroic poetry, psychology, and theology. Terpsichore is dance. Melpomene is tragedy and literature. Erato is lyric and love poetry. Euterpe is music. Urania is astronomy, astrology, alchemy, and physics. Thalia is comedy, the world of nature. And Polyhymnia is song. Well, that gives you quite a gamut of choices of spheres. My particular interest in Greek drama and opera are both that ideally those are areas where all of the arts of all of the muses are included. In Greek drama, in the ancient productions, they were not orated, they were sung. Classical Greek is a pitched language. So it was sung, and in the ancient world, everybody danced. I mean, the Greeks now, everybody dances. So Greek drama included, well, it was bringing myths alive in song and dance. And opera has the same opportunity to bring all of these forces to bear. Sometimes, admittedly, it becomes lopsided, and you will hear people in opera act as though the singers are the only ones who are doing anything of great importance. But ideally, opera is the plural of opus. It's the works. It ideally includes all of this so that all of the senses are employed. Because what do the muses do? The muses cause the soul to remember its forgotten higher estate. They're a balancing force between impulse and inhibition. Incredible gateways of potential energy. Gateways between conscious and unconscious cognition. We can only open these centers if we give them a chance to emanate creative power, and that involves feeling. This chorus of Apollo, who is the god of the sun, prophecy, healing, and the arts, god of reason, and patron of all sorts of artists. This chorus, transcending time and space, inspires humanity with the memory of the enduring harmony of the universe. Joseph Campbell, in his description of this passage, talks about the energy in this way: whereupon the rapture of the muses, the arts, will begin to be experienced in the body of this world, transporting our spirit from glory to glory to that summit of consciousness where the world's eye, beyond hope, beyond fear, surveys the universe in its coming, going, and being. Apollo trained the muses to be his chorus, the accompaniment to his lyre. So the muses are the divine music for life's dance. With Apollo, as I said, there are always artistic challenges, intellectual and emotional stimulation. Let's consider some of the key Greek words that we commonly use in their connections: enthusiasm, ecstasy, and archetype. Because active amusing involves all three. Enthusiasm comes from enthusiasmos, possession by the god, or enthos theos, to be filled with God. Ecstasy comes from ekstasis, to be standing outside of oneself. And archetype from archetypos, just molded, pattern, example. And image? What is image? The concept or someone or something that is held by or projected to the public. This making a second meaning, to make a likeness, mirror, reflect, project, conjure up, imagine. And emovere, to move out, stir up, agitate. Emotion is essential for activating this creative agency for consciousness, but you can't analyze while feeling. To experience events is one thing. To release from them vital and creative meaning is another, a process of imaginative identification. Campbell has said that consciousness is not a product of the brain. The brain is an organ of consciousness. And we can look at the fact that the brain is a wonderful servant, but a terrible master. Enthusiasm, ecstasy, image, and emotion. We can take these as nodal points, which act as termini or power stations through which, as it were, the root life stream flows and is diluted or transmuted so as to be assimilable or available to a lower form of life. Well, as a species, we're certainly not conditioned to think of ourselves as a lower life form. After all, we're the top of the food chain and all that. However, to be nodal points, to open these points within ourselves, involves being open to the Apollonian mind, but allowing the energy to flow from the Dionysian realm. I think it was William Blake who said, go to hell for the energy and heaven for the form, and marry the two. Pretty good description of art. The director, Peter Brook, has talked about this particular state in an interview called Leaning on the Moment. And he says, theater is just like life because it's made up of the elements of life. What else could it be made up of? But it can't have any interest for us unless it has a particular quality that we don't have otherwise. As for me, that quality is increased perception, so that the introduction of factors that heighten the possibility of more intense vision is what makes the theater event. To make the heightening factor, there have to be two compressions. The only difference between theater and life is that in the theater, life takes place in compressed space and compressed time. It is like looking at biological life with a microscope, where the field is intensified because it is limited. But if a biologist tried to do this with all of nature at once, he would see nothing. And it happens through the same laws of compression, just for that compressed time, in that compressed space, with that compression of gesture. Yes, that is possible. And at that moment, I'm right back to where we started, two worlds meet. At that moment, he is there with what he has to offer, which is his everyday person, which he isn't concealing. He is what he is. And yet, for a tiny space of time, he becomes the meeting point with something else which expresses itself through him. So theater is life, but in a different mode. De Castillejo, in her Knowing Woman, talks about the problem of inflation and the arts. She says, yes, to identify with an archetype is inflation indeed, but when we are loaned wings, and she makes a big point if the wings are on loan, when you're loaned wings, oh goodness, you go with it. If you think you're going to fly there when they're no longer on loan and your time is out, then you're going to have the classic crash that comes with inflation. But to avoid that loan because, oh goodness, I might inflate, is to cut yourself off from a very important area of your own creativity. So this act of amusing is a way of stirring up the picture and of having our various dimensions conscious of each other's reality within a rationally irrational form or container. Energy and form, Zeus and memory give us through the muses connecting links to the collective unconscious or the imagination of nature. The central figure is Apollo, and his extension through the different realms is through this three-headed serpent. We're back to the serpent power in Dionysus. In The Wisdom of the Serpent, Joseph Henderson explains that the snake is the root of this transcendent power still contained in the unconscious. It implies no certain knowledge, but only an intuition of liberation for the suffering ego emerging from the coils of illusion in a world of blind passion, and so is a kind of hermetic finger pointing to some sort of spiritual salvation. In its sinuous, unpredictable movement, it frequently illustrates the indirect, non-rational approach to the unconscious, most necessary if anything new is to be learned. Along the winding path of the serpent, we meet the muses, a way of ascent. The serpent is not opposed to Apollo, but is a manifestation of his creative force and harmony. And so we address ourselves to the darkness as well as to the light, to the sonic forces, to Demeter, Persephone, Hecate, to Hades and Dionysus, because they have something to give us, vital energy, creative power, but only after we come to terms with our own shadow. There's the old saying, you can't have the angel on one shoulder without the demon on the other, and they are equal in strength. This creative power is a responsibility, a responsibility. And there are two kinds of creative power, the power to be effectively what one is as a particular form of existence, and the power to use what one is within a greater whole in which one is called upon to function. Great deeds can only be accomplished when we are more than our little selves. And the De Castillejo quote is, when we are lent wings, we should not reject them. Keeping the loan on mind helps to avoid the inflation that otherwise plugs the channel and clogs the process. Art, the muses, musiki, music, is an experience. But if you do not enter experience with emotion, it will not change you. What unites us universally is our emotions, our feelings in the face of experience, and not necessarily the actual experiences. We do not escape into philosophy, psychology, and art. We go there to restore our shattered selves into one whole, to remember, to remake ourselves. It's beautiful, and it's terrible, and it's a lot of hard work. There are amplifications of the dream world, certainly. And through intellectual muses, some of the muses, you will be dealing with symbology, mythology, mysticism, folklore, history of religion, etc. There are also the physical amplifications, incorporating the psyche as the inward experience of the body. And this is where we get into song, dance, chant. When I've presented this program with a workshop format, what we do in the afternoon is a create a myth where people in groups decide on a theme and they choose a force that they're going to represent and they give it a name and they make up a chant and they make up a dance. Very simple. It doesn't have to be an intricate thing, but that sense, that creative sense that I experience, it's not unique to me, but that aha kind of thing when you're creative and you're thinking and all of a sudden get this wonderful idea and you feel sort of poised between the worlds. Well, if you look at the expression on the face of a singer singing a wonderful high note, they look happy because it feels very good. The side effect that it may be earning them lots of money or impressing lots of people is a whole other matter. It feels very good. The sense of dance when there's that sense of having an energy move through you. Well, of course it's your own energy. I'm not talking about some possession by something outside of yourself. But if the psyche is the inward experience of the body, if you leave out those particular muses that involve any physical sensation, you're cutting off an aspect that might be very useful. And goodness knows, it's a lot easier to experience the the psyche in the body in that way than other ways. I have found that working in opera, I love to work in opera, because as long as I am doing all of these productions and I'm thinking about them and using whatever production I'm in as part of my individuatory exercises, so to speak, my personal life is real calm. However, if I leave the arts totally alone, which I've done periodically, and I don't have that creative container, then I have to live it out on a much more personal and much less pleasant level. Now, that's a function that the arts can have. And I see some faces going, that sounds scary. You want to ask about it now? You want to wait till later? Okay. It's a tool. It's a tool. So looking at the Muses, Rhea, Apollo, and the Three Graces, we have three graces with three different names. Aglaia is Splendor. She's the one who's facing the god. Aglaia, Splendor. We also have Euphrosyne, which is Mirth. And she's kind of looking away. Thalia has managed to be in the middle, so she's got herself being a combination of the two. Campbell says that Thalia above suggests Eve in her state of purity. Euphrosyne, or Mirth, Eve turned away from God and her inclination to rebellion, and Thalia below, Eve in exile, subject to the serpent and consequently to the fears, hopes, and bereavements of time. And finally, the grace Aglaia, Splendor, with her gaze turned toward the god. Here at the top, we see Thalia, muse of nature, in her dancing place. But there is this other Thalia at the bottom, beneath the three heads of the serpent. The wolf, the lion, and the dog, symbolizing past, present, and future. The wolf dragging away the past, the dog fawning on its master for the future, and the lion, the fiery head of the present that Thalia must enter to reach herself again. This is Thalia Surda. This is Thalia unheard. The world of nature, us, cut off from Apollo and our place with the graces. I'm reminded of Goethe's fragment on nature. At each moment she starts.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CG Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.